wheeled overhead. Their whirling reflections were like dark winged fish swimming in the smooth water below. Willa looked at the serene water of the lake in astonishment. She had lived her whole life in a world of whispering streams, gushing rivers, and tumbling waterfalls, a place where water was always moving. But this flat, motionless lake was an amazement she had never seen before. Noticing a dark shape moving down the slope, she turned to see the old, sickened bear making its way toward the sandy shore of the lake. The bear lumbered into the water, and then sunk its body down into it, grunting air through its nose in sounds of immense relief. The water seemed to soothe the pain of its aching body. Willa looked along the edge of the lake. There were other bears, too, many of them brown or black, but others cinnamon or blue-gray, all up and down the shore, some of them swimming or wallowing in the water, others just sitting in the wet sand at the water's edge. Luthien jolted in surprise when a massive white bear rose up in front of her, roaring in anger. Willa pulled in a startled breath and clung tightly to Luthien's back, pressing her face into the thick fur of the wolf's neck. But instead of pulling back at the sight of the gigantic bear, Luthien leapt forward with her teeth snapping in a savage growl. The vibration of the wolf's growl vibrated through Willa's body. She pressed herself to Luthien as the bear stood on its hind legs and roared, outraged that the wolves had dared to come to this sacred place. The other wolves of the pack pulled back, and the whimpering pups scattered, but Luthien held her ground. Willa could see that this bear was much larger and much older than any of the other bears. This was his lake, and he was going to protect it from intruders like these wolves. A single swipe of his enormous paw would easily kill a wolf or a Faerun girl. But then, to her surprise, she realized that the bear wasn't just looking at Luthien. He was looking at her. Her skin and hair had reflexively blended into the color and texture of the wolf's fur. In all appearance, she had become part of the wolf. But the bear appeared to be able to smell her, and its dark eyes gazed in her direction. There was an uncertainty in the bear's expression, as if he thought he might know what she was, but he hadn't seen her kind in a long, long time. As the white bear slowly stopped snarling, Luthien did the same. The bear peered at Willa. She wanted to look away, to avert her eyes. She wanted to run away. But she held the bear's gaze. Finally, the white bear dropped down onto all fours with a muffled grunt, and Willa let out a breath of relief. "Thank you," she said in the old language, loud enough for the bear to hear. "My name is Willa. My grandmother told me about your strength and your wisdom. I am honored to meet you." The white bear made a low, guttural sound and turned his head and his body toward the lake.
"He's letting us through,"
Willa whispered to Luthien. As Luthien stepped slowly toward the water, the other wolves stayed where they were, even the two males who served as her guards. They seemed to understand that only Willa and Luthien were allowed to pass, and pressing the issue further would result in a battle that neither the wolves nor the bears wanted to fight. As Willa and Luthien moved cautiously past the white bear, she could see that he was extremely old. He didn't appear weak or decrepit, but she could see the knowingness in his eyes and the gray streaks of time in his weathered face. She sensed that he had been living far longer than any Faerun or animal she had ever met. For many years, her mamma had taken her and her sister Aliyu through the cathedrals of the giant hemlocks, teaching them how to speak with trees more than 500 years old. Willa knew that bears normally didn't live as long as Faerun, but she had a feeling that this particular bear had been a cub when those age-old trees had been saplings. As Luthien took her down to the edge of the water, goosebumps rose on Willa's arms. She knew it was going to be cold. Every mountain stream she had ever entered had been shockingly, bracingly frigid, like melted snow. But as Luthien lowered her slowly into the lake, Willa realized the water was warm and soothing. It felt as if the light of the sun had become liquid. As she leaned back into the water with only her face above the surface, her body felt weightless, her arms rising buoyant at her side, her hair floating around her head. She sighed in relief as slow, gentle waves rippled one after another through her body, lifting the pain away. She felt the torn skin of her wounds slowly coming back together, as if a month of healing had occurred in a few moments. Her grandmother had told her and Aliyu of a hidden lake that the Cherokee called Atagahi and a great white bear who protected it. From a distance, the lake looked like nothing more than one of the many mist-filled valleys, but hidden below the clouds was a powerful healing place where sick and wounded bears came for refuge. The great white bear encouraged his ursine kin to come to the sacred lake, but guarded it fiercely from all others. As Willa floated in the water, letting its healing powers move through her aching wounds, the white bear suddenly rose up onto his hind legs in alarm and looked toward the rim of the valley. The quills on the back of Willa's neck went taut as she quickly got her legs beneath her and crouched down in the water. She couldn't believe it. It was the man who had shot her. He was standing on the rocky ridge, holding his killing stick as he stared out across the mist-filled valley. His dog stood at his side. It was clear that they had followed her here, and they were still looking for her. Luthien had carried her a great distance up through steep, rocky terrain that must have been exceedingly difficult for the man to climb. He must have run as fast as he could to chase her. What storm of dark anger and hatred had driven him to follow her so far? Luthien stepped forward, growling and snarling, her shoulders bunched for the attack. The wolves of the pack maneuvered for battle. The white bear moaned a low and menacing growl, his teeth clacking as the other bears gathered to his side, ready to fight. "Don't see us," Willa whispered as she gazed up at the man, her heart filling with dread, not just of the human and his dog, but of what would happen if they came down into the valley. "Don't see us," she said again. She knew that if the man saw the wolves and bears, he'd become frightened, shooting his killing stick this way and that, and they'd attack in return. The man and the dog, and many of the wolves and the bears, would die. No dayfolk man or woman had ever seen the healing lake of the bears. They might have heard about it from the stories of the Cherokee. They might have even searched for it. But none of them had ever lived to tell about it. "Just turn away," Willa whispered as she gazed up through the fog toward the man. "Whoever you are, whatever you want with me, for your own sake, please just turn away." Chapter 9. When the man finally turned and headed in a different direction, Willa thought, "Yes, go. Take your killing stick and your hatred away from here." Luthien's hackles lowered, and Willa sunk back down into the water. The bears, too, returned to their wallowing in the nearby shallows as the white bear watched over them. She liked how the white bear was older and stronger than the other bears, but he was serving them, helping them, protecting them. Her mamma had told her stories about how it had once been the same with the Farron, that all the members of the clan would work together, protect each other, take care of each other. When the lake had finally stopped the bleeding and soothed the pain of her wounds, Willa climbed back up onto Luthien's back.
"I wish I could stay here," Willa said in the old language. "But I need to get back to my clan. They're going to be looking for me."
Willa noticed the white bear watching her as Luthien carried her out of the water and up onto the shore. She knew that this bear had seen so many things with those eyes. The time of the first Cherokee long ago, with their skin-piercing blow darts and their spear-slinging otlottles, then the homesteaders hacking their way through the wilderness with their sharpened blades and their killing sticks, and now the newcomers with their smoking metal beasts. As the white bear looked at her, he seemed to be thinking,
"And you see it too, don't you, little one? You understand."
As Luthien and Willa rejoined the pack, the wolves circled around them in greeting, and then they all headed off together, with Luthien leading the way. They traveled for several hours, up into the dark realms of the great mountain, following secluded ravines along rivers that washed the stones bone gray, and up through shoots of ancient rock where once the water flowed. Willa and the wolves came to a gorge where a gigantic skeleton of a dead tree hung upside down, wedged between two rock faces where a rushing flood had deposited it years before. Its roots reached up into the air, and its branches hung down to the earth. The water had receded long ago, but the bare gray trunk and limbs of the tree remained. Her people called it the Watcher, for it loomed over the winding path that led up through the rocky gorge to the entrance of the Dead Hollow Lair. When Luthien came to a stop, Willa climbed reluctantly off the wolf's back. Glancing up into the gorge in the direction of her clan's lair, Willa felt sick to her stomach. She didn't want to return to her clan. She wanted to go back to the Lake of the Bears. She wanted to stay with the wolves. She wanted to do anything other than return. But she knew she couldn't. A Farron could only survive through her clan. The Padawan had told them many times,
"There is no I. There is only we."
She belonged to her clan. And more than anything, she had to get back to her grandmother. Her mamma needed her, and she needed her mamma.
"There is no I. Only we."
As the wolves of the pack gathered around her to say goodbye, she knelt down in front of Luthien. Willa knew that to be touched by a wolf was a privilege, but to actually be carried by a wolf like Luthien was a great honor. Luthien had saved her life, and risked her own life to do it. Willa wrapped her arms around Luthien's neck and hugged her, feeling the thickness of the wolf's fur against her cheek. When Luthien nuzzled up against her, Willa knew the wolf understood. Willa felt a loyalty toward her that she vowed to remember. "I will never forget what you've done for me, Luthien," Willa said in the old language. "May your pack run strong." In the moments that followed, she watched Luthien and the other wolves turn and slowly disappear into the forest. When they were finally gone, she felt a lurch of loneliness in her chest. She didn't want to be left behind. She wanted to cry out to them, to raise her head up and howl for them to come back for her. As she turned and looked toward the path that would take her back to Dead Hollow, the lair of the clan into which she had been born, she felt a lump of dark fear growing like black roots in the pit of her stomach. Chapter 10. Before she went home, there was one more thing she had to do. When the Yaders went out thieving each night, they usually went out in small groups to keep an eye on one another, a rule the Padawan had established long before she was born. Nothing in the clan was ever done alone. But more and more, she'd been sneaking out by herself, and the other Yaders didn't like it. They often lay in wait for her return. She looked around at the surrounding forest to make sure she was alone, then went over to the Watcher, the tree wedged upside down in the gorge. She grabbed onto the lowest branches and started climbing, wincing from the pain in her shoulder. She knew that the movement of climbing might tear open the wound that the lake had soothed and begun to heal, but she had no choice. She scaled the branches hand over hand, following the tree all the way up until she came to a large, oblong hole that had been dug into the trunk. Looking down inside the cavity, she saw the tiny, sharply angled faces of 5 baby pileated woodpeckers looking up at her.
"How are you this morning, my little ones?" she whispered.
But it was a careless mistake. As soon as she said hello, all the babies started squawking and cackling, excited to see her.
"Shh, shh, shh," she whispered. "Just soft now. Don't give me away. I need you to hold on to something for me."
But as she pulled the satchel off her shoulder, the mother woodpecker came flying in with a burst of black and white feathers and clung to the trunk of the tree with her powerful claws. Willow was startled to see that something had happened to her since she saw her last. The area around her left eye was bleeding, and her wing was badly bent, crumpled close to her body. It was a wonder that she could fly at all.
"Come here," Willa said, clinging to the tree with her legs as she reached out and took the crow-sized bird into her hands. "Let me look at you."
The woodpecker knew she was trying to help her and did not fight her or try to fly away. A tangle of fibrous twine had wrapped tightly around the wing and body of the bird, biting cruelly into her skin and binding her movement. But as Willa investigated more closely, she could see that it wasn't just bits of string. It was pieces of a net of some kind.
"Oh my, who did this to you?" Willa said as she carefully unwrapped the bird's wing from the twisted fragments.
It would have taken days to kill her, but the woodpecker would not have survived this, nor would her starving babies.
"You must have fought very hard to get out of this net," Willa said, the woodpecker watching her with its rapidly blinking eyes as she worked. "There you go. You're all clear now. I hope you feel better."
The woodpecker bobbed its head, then tended to her babies.
"Why would someone be using a net in the forest?" Willa wondered. "Is this some kind of cruel new weapon or trap the Dayfolk are using?"
Knowing that she needed to get back to what she'd come for, Willa scanned the area below her one last time to make sure no one was watching. Then she stuffed her satchel into the cavity with the baby woodpeckers, careful not to block them or hurt them in any way.
"I know it's crowded in there," she told the little ones, "but I'll be back for it very soon. Don't worry."
Hiding valuables in trees was a trick she and her sister had learned from playing games with the ravens years before, but Willa was pleased with her cleverness. Even the mighty ravens wouldn't think of using an occupied woodpecker hole as a hiding spot. What she was bringing back to the lair in her satchel was a good take, something she should be proud of, but she knew she was too tired to defend it from Gredek and her other Yater rivals. As she climbed down the tree and the sunlight peeked into the gorge, her gut tightened with worry. If the sun was already in the ravine, that meant it was late in the morning. The Padawan was going to be angry that she'd been gone all night and that she wasn't at the morning gathering. The other Yaders would come looking for her, sensing her weakness. She had to get back to the lair as soon as she could.
"What are you doing?" came a hissing voice from behind her,
as soon as she stepped foot on the ground. The quills on the back of Willa's neck went straight up as she spun around to defend herself. 4 Yaders surrounded her with their long sticks.
"Don't try to get away, Willa,"
Gredek hissed in the Anglish words, the only language he knew, as he shoved her hard up against the rocky wall of the ravine. Years before, she and Gredek had been initiated into the Yaders at the same time, but he was a year older than her, and at least 6 inches taller than her now, with clawed, grasping fingers and slimy, mottled gray skin. Like most of the Farron of her clan, Gredek's skin didn't change color to match his surroundings. Blending, or weaving, as her mamma called it, was a fading remnant of the past that had been dying out of the clan. Her mother, father, sister, and mamma had it. And she had it. It ran strong in families. But few of the other Farron had the ability, and the young Yaders of her clan never let her forget how different she was from the rest of them.
"Look at her, she's going all stony brown,"
Gredek's twin brother chided her as he pushed her head against the stone.
"Let's make her face change color, too."
His name was Kydurg, and he was the largest and most brutal of the Yaders. The crooked nose and crushed cheekbones of Kydurg's mangled face were remnants of the savage fight the year before that defeated his brother's rival and put Gredek in charge of the Yaders. But it was the nasty Kiernan and his brother, Ninraik, who scared Willa the most.
"I think you're frightening her," Kiernan rasped in snarling, fidgeting pleasure from behind the other 2 Yaders as he wiped his nose with the back of his gnarled hand. Kiernan and his brother were sniveling creatures with black, needy eyes that oozed a sticky, sap-like substance. Fascinated with everything Gredek did, they liked to watch, whether he was pulling the wings off a sparrow or pinning Willa against a rock and making her twist in pain. Willa squirmed and tried to yank away, but Gredek gripped her arms with his clenching hands. It had always frustrated her that he was so much stronger than her.
"Where's your satchel, Willa?"
he hissed, leaning his face so close to her that his foul-smelling breath crept into her nose like leeches.
"Yes, yes, where's your satchel?"
Kiernan rasped from behind him, always repeating Gredek's words.
"Are you scared, Willa?" Gredek whispered into her face. "Can you feel your heart beating and your blood pumping?"
"Let's take her blood!" Kiernan shrieked.
"She's already bleeding,"
Kydurg said, jabbing his stick at the wound on her back, as his brother held her. Gredek wrenched her around by the arm and looked at her.
"You're hurt,"
he said in surprise, his eyes narrowing at her suspiciously.
"The little beastie is hurt," Kiernan hissed.
When Gredek dug his probing fingers into the bloody wound, it sent sharp bolts of pain roiling through her back. She tried to squirm away from him, but he gripped her arm even tighter and shook her.
"Where did you go, Willa? Tell me."
"Leave me alone," she said, as she tried to pull away from him. But he held her tight and his voice went quiet as he pushed against her.
"What did you do, Willa?"
he whispered.
"What are you hiding?"
Gredek was far smarter than the other Yaders, and she could hear the fear seeping into his voice. He often used his anger as his power, shouting at her and the other Yaders to get what he wanted. But just as often, he was kind to her, almost gentle with her when he felt sorry for her or was helping her, when his power was secure. But his kindness vanished when he thought she was slipping away from him in some way or getting an edge on him. He knew that this wound from a different place meant that wherever she had gone that night, whatever she had done it without him. And this he would not allow. She and Gredek had gone through the starving nights and beating blows of the Yater initiation together, and in the years since, when the Yaters went out thieving, he had made sure the two of them were in the same group. There is no I, only we. Gredek yanked her around to face him again and pressed her back against the wall with a harsh shove.
"Tell me what you did!"
he demanded again, crushing her with his weight as he slipped his long, bony hands tightly around her neck. Chapter 11. She struggled against him, but Willa knew she couldn't fight Gredek. She couldn't overpower him. She couldn't strike him with a blow to defeat him. He was far too strong. And with his brutish brother, Kydurg, and the nasty Kiernan, and all the other Yaters who followed him, he had far too many allies. As he pressed her up against the rock wall, the jagged edges of the stone jammed into her shoulder blades, driving a slash of pain into her wound. He pushed against her so hard that she could barely expand her chest enough to take a breath. But as the grip of Gredek's fingers slowly squeezed her throat shut, she pushed out a few last words.
"Let me speak, Gredek,"
she wheezed. Gredek leaned his face close to hers and looked into her eyes.
"I'm warning you. No tricks, Willa. Don't try to run."
"I will not run," she said, her voice thin and raspy through the grip of his fingers.
"Swear it,"
he demanded.
"I swear that I will not run," she said.
Finally, Gredek loosened his grip on her throat and stepped back away from her.
"Now, tell me what happened to you last night. Where's your satchel?"
At that moment, Willa blended herself into the color and texture of the lichen that clung to the rock. She wove herself so completely into the world around her that she disappeared. Her skin, her eyes, her hair. She vanished. Although they'd seen her do it before, the Farron boys gasped, as much in anger as in surprise. Gredek immediately reached out to grab her again, but she had already dropped to the ground and curled into a little ball at the base of the rock.
"Where'd she go?"
Kydurg shouted, sweeping his stick back and forth through the open air where he'd seen her last.
"She's tricked us!"
Kiernan shrieked.
"Just find her!"
Gredek screamed in frustration as he searched the ground around him. Willa had promised she wouldn't run. And she didn't. She crawled slowly and invisibly away from the Yater boys. They searched frantically for her, flailing their arms around them and poking with their sticks. They stabbed into the ground and jabbed into trees. They rustled bushes and kicked up dirt. But their efforts were useless. They couldn't find her. Finally, Gredek said,
"Come on. She'll have to come back to the lair sooner or later, and we'll catch her then."
"We'll catch her then,"
Kiernan repeated, dragging his hand across his nose as they headed off.
"The Pateran's gonna be burning that she didn't come home last night,"
Kydurg said, seeming to relish the thought.
"There's no slinking away from that."
"Maybe not,"
Gredek said.
"But whatever we do, we need to get her satchel before she sees the Pateran. She must have something good to be doing all this."
As the Yater boys climbed up through the rocky gorge, following the path that led beneath the Watcher hanging between its stony walls, they finally disappeared into the distance. But she knew she hadn't seen the last of them. They'd be waiting, ready to filch her satchel and drag her empty-handed before the Pateran in shame. Her mamma had told her that many of the Yaters had no parents or grandparents to raise them, and that they had lost their way. And just as with the humans, that which the Yaters did not understand, they destroyed. And that meant her. When she was certain the Yaters were well gone, and she thought it was safe for her to come out of her hiding place, she climbed back up the giant tree and retrieved her satchel from the woodpecker's hole. She knew it was dangerous to carry it, but she realized now, more than ever, that she was going to need it as soon as she returned to Dead Hollow. Just as she began to start her climb down, she heard voices below her. She gazed from her bird's-eye view down into the gorge to see a band of the Padoran's guards winding along the path and going out into the forest. They were moving quickly and with purpose, carrying their spears as well as other equipment she couldn't make out. She'd never seen anything like it. The guards seemed to be in some sort of hunting party, but Farron didn't hunt the animals of the forest. She knew she couldn't take the main path into the lair, so when she finally climbed down, she took one of the side routes, then split off on her own through the steep and rocky forest. She climbed up and over a thicket-strangled ridge, her arm and shoulder hurting all the way. The healing lake of the bears had stopped the bleeding and saved her life, but the jabbing sticks and probing fingers of the Yater boys had reopened the wound. She could feel the sticky blood oozing down her back. Finally, she could see the lair of her people. From a distance, the part of the Dead Hollow lair that was visible on the surface of the earth looked like a vast hornet's nest, with the same rough, gray-brown, irregular shape, but instead of being made from the hornet's sticky paper, the walls of the lair were made from a mesh of thousands of interwoven sticks. The walls had once been green and alive, woven together and sustained in life by the wood witches of the Farron past. They had used the same powerful woodcraft her mamma had taught her, the same language she used to ask the trees to help her cross the river or intertwine around her when she needed to disappear. But the lair's walls were long dead now. Dead for more than 100 years, her mamma said. The sticks twisted and rotting, blackened by age, their roots decayed, for the woodcraft needed to keep the walls alive had long faded from the ways of the Farron. There just weren't enough woodwitches to keep the lair green and alive anymore. The very name woodwitch had become a title of scorn, even fear, to many in the clan, and the Padoran had forbidden the old ways. Willa climbed down into the gorge on the backside of the lair where few Farron ever crept. She found the spot that her mamma had told her about, where 3 large rocks had crashed down from the wall of the ravine and left a small triangular hole that looked like nothing more than a crack in the stone. Getting down onto her hands and knees, she crawled inside. The crack became so tight that she had to get down onto her shoulder and wiggle her way along like a centipede. When she finally reached the other side, she crawled out of the stone crack and found herself hunched in a small room enclosed with walls of twisting, wet, rotting sticks. She wrinkled her mouth in revulsion at the dank stench of decaying branches that filled the air. Putrid sludge dripped from the ceiling. This area of the lair had been abandoned for decades, and had been strictly forbidden by the Padoran, too dangerous for members of the clan to enter. Anxious to get out of this wretched part of the lair, she followed a narrow tunnel. It turned, and then turned again, until she came to a split that led off into several different directions. She picked the one that led upward, and kept moving. She had to get home to her mamma. The inside of the Dead Hollow lair consisted of a maze of woven stick tunnels, black and sticky from years of use, that wound through the gullet of the gorge into the small, darkened rooms and secluded caves of her people. It had once been home to many thousands of Farron, but now only a few hundred remained, and there were many dark and empty places like this one left behind, old storage areas and dens where Farron once lived, filled with nothing but the echoes of those who had come before. The tunnels of the lair connected one to the other like wormholes twisting and writhing through the earth. As Willa tried to navigate her way back home, the wound on her shoulder began to throb. A wave of dizziness passed through her, and she nearly toppled to the floor. She clutched the wall to catch her balance and rest. When she touched her hand to the wound on her back, her fingers came back bright and slippery with fresh blood. Thanks to the healing lake of the bears, she felt a dull ache rather than a sharp pain. But her wound was bleeding again. If she couldn't find her way through these old tunnels, she was going to die here and no one would ever know. She had to continue on. She came to a place where the tunnel split into three different directions, and she wasn't sure which way to go. She sniffed the air of each tunnel. In the tunnel on the left, she thought she could smell the distant scents of her clan. She hoped it led upward toward the more active parts of the lair. But then she heard a disturbing whimpering sound coming from the tunnel that led down to the right. She stopped and stayed quiet as she tried to identify the sound. It wasn't the wind howling wraith-like through the empty tunnels like it sometimes did. It sounded more like a wounded animal. When she heard the sound again, fear seeped into her body. She wiped her dry lips with the back of her hand. There was something down that tunnel. She could smell it. She wanted to go in the opposite direction. She wanted to get home. She had to get home. But the sound, it wasn't a whimpering animal. She heard it again. It was a voice. She took a few uncertain steps into the tunnel and cupped her hands behind her ears to focus the sound. She heard something dragging across the woven stick floor. Then she heard something breathing. Her chest began to rise and fall more heavily, pulling air into her lungs. She tilted her head and sniffed. The smell was oddly familiar. But it did not belong here. Not here. Her palms began to sweat. It was the smell of a human. How is that possible? She thought in confusion. That can't be. She took a few more steps down the tunnel toward the noises she had heard. There were woven stick doors on each side, with thorny vines binding them shut so that whatever was inside could not get out. As she peered through the lattice of sticks, she realized that there wasn't an actual room on the other side of each door, but a small enclosure, some sort of prison cell. Then she saw, crammed into the hole, closed in by impenetrable woven stick walls, was a small Cherokee boy, about 10 years old, staring out at her with wide, pleading eyes. Chapter 12. This human boy should not be here, Willa thought. The Farron people did not attack humans. They did not capture humans and hold them prisoner. She wanted to turn away from this. She wanted to run. She wasn't supposed to be here. This was the forbidden part of the lair. If the Padawan's guards caught her here, she'd be in even worse trouble than she already was. And the wound on her back ached. Her arms and legs and her whole body felt weak and clammy from the loss of blood. But she stayed perfectly still for several seconds, just trying to breathe, trying to understand, as the Cherokee boy's dark brown eyes stared out at her. Why is there a human here? She thought. What are they doing with it? She could see its little brown hands clinging to the door of sticks that imprisoned it. And as she peered deeper into its hole, she saw that it was thin and dirty and bleeding. She felt the stab of a strange and unpleasant emotion twisting in her gut, but she quickly hardened her mind. If it had been an animal or a Farron in this cell, she would have been right to feel sorry for it. But it wasn't. It was a human. Enemy of the clan. Murderer of her people. It wasn't a him. It was an it. And she was forbidden to have anything to do with it.
Can you help me?
It whispered in a weak and desperate voice, wiping the long black hair from its face. She stepped back, startled. She knew that the Cherokee spoke the English words as well as their own, but the sound of its voice frightened her. She could hear the weakness, the fear, the starvation of it. She could hear it all. And she didn't want to hear it.
"Do you have food?"
it asked. "The creature is starving," she thought in revulsion. It was as if someone had captured a wild bobcat and put it in a cage. No matter what you did with the bobcat, it was still a bobcat. It needed meat to survive. Out in the world, down in the valleys of the Dayfolk, where she made her nightly takes, it would never even occur to her to help a human boy, to actually feed one. They were tree killers. How could she help such a beastly little creature? She could not give this boy food. She didn't have any human food to give it. She had never seen or heard of her people taking prisoners, but the Pateran and his guards must have captured this human and put it here for a reason, something important to the clan. It would be an act of great disobedience to feed it without permission. She knew all this. And she had no food. It was impossible.
"I'll eat anything," the boy begged her. "I'm just so hungry. Please."
"Shut your mouth," she ordered it, her mind darting from one thought to another, trying to make sense of what was happening. And then she remembered. There was something in her satchel. She looked down the corridor, first one way and then the other. "This must be some sort of prison," she thought, "hidden down here in the old part of the lair. But if it's a prison, there must be guards." She thought the guards might come down the corridor at any moment and find her here. And they'd punish her for her disobedience against the clan. They'd lock her in one of these slimy holes and bind the door shut like they had with the boy. She could not help this boy. It was impossible.
"Get what you came for, Willa," she told herself angrily. "Get yourself home."
But it was no use. She knelt down on the floor.
"You must stay quiet," she told the boy as she opened her satchel.
Watching her hands, the boy nodded obediently. As its little fingers grasped the sticks that imprisoned it, she could see the brown under the fingernails where it had tried to scratch its way out. She could smell the sweat of its body and the blood of its wounds. She reached into her satchel and pulled out one of the lumps she had stolen from the lair of the man. She pushed the crumbly food through the lattice of sticks that separated her from the boy. The boy took the lump gratefully and shoved it in its mouth. She fed it another lump, and it ate the lump even more quickly than the first one, for it had learned to trust her, to take whatever she gave it.
"These are so good, thank you," it said as it chomped the next lump down. "Do not speak to me," she said fiercely, her face flaring with red as she suddenly remembered what a foolish thing she was doing.
The startled boy pulled back into its cell.
"Why am I here?" he asked. "Why have you taken me?"
Willa's eyes widened in surprise.
"I haven't taken you," she said.
And as soon as she said the words, she felt so out of place, so disobedient, to be defiantly separating herself from the clan in this way. There is no I, only we. There was the clan. There was the us and the them. There was no I. I was a person alone. I was an impossibility. I was something that shriveled alone and died. Only through the cooperation of the clan did a Farron survive. But she had said it, and she had said it strong. "I haven't taken you," she had said. She knew she was part of the clan, but she wanted nothing to do with this. You run from humans, you hide from them, you steal from them, but you don't hurt them. You don't do this to them. If you're not one of them, then who are you? The boy asked. The question struck her mind like a blow. Who are you? It was the second time a human had asked her that question. My name is Willa, she said, unsure why she was allowing herself to talk to the human at all. The Cherokee boy pressed its face against the lattice of sticks that formed the little window in the door. And now she could see it studying her, looking at the dirt on her arms and legs, and the smears of dried blood on her face. You look like you might be pretty hungry, too, it said. You should eat some of the cookies. You eat them, she said, pushing the last two through the sticks at it. I will have food soon enough when I get back home. Thank you, it said as it gratefully ate the last two lumps. My name's Iska. What's going to happen to me? Why am I here? Please help me. The sound of approaching footsteps interrupted the boy's words. Willa jumped to her feet. The prison guards were coming. Chapter 13. The two guards spotted her in front of the boy's cell as they came around the corner. They were tall, gangly Farron with grim, grayish faces, muscled arms and chests, and sharpened wooden spears.
What are you doing down here?
One shouted at Willa.
Stop there!
To disobey the commands of one of the Padawan's guards was a great offense against the clan, but she was a rabbit under the claws of a swooping hawk. She fled, tearing down the corridor in the only direction she could go, deeper into the prison, every muscle in her body snapping with fear, her lungs sucking in air at a frantic pace. The outraged guards chased after her, determined to catch her, to stab her with their spears. They'd drag her in shame before the Padawan for her disobedience, or shove her into one of their black cells. As she whipped around a corner, she heard the footfalls of the guards behind her, felt the vibration of their pounding, running steps on the woven stick floor. She threw herself against the wall and pinned herself flat. Her whole body buzzing, she closed her eyes and tried to blend into the wall.
Stay still,
she told herself as she forced her heart to a slow and steady beat.
Just stay still. I am the wall. I am the wall,
she repeated in her mind, and prayed that it would be enough. As she quieted her heart and held her breath, the guards ran past her, one brushing by her so close that she felt the movement of the air on her cheek.
What was that girl doing down here?
One of the guards asked the other as they ran by, his voice so loud in her quiet mind that it felt like it could knock her from the wall.
Did you see her face?
The other asked.
It looked like one of the Yater girls. We've got to tell the Padawan.
As the sound of the guards faded into the distance, Willa pulled in a much-needed breath and stepped away from the wall. She immediately headed in the opposite direction from the guards, anxious to get out of the prison. But as she made her way up the corridor, she passed many cell doors and caught glimpses of faces in the woven stick walls. They were strange white faces with blue eyes and brown eyes looking out at her as she passed, their spidery white fingers clinging to the sticks that bound them. Many more dayfolk boys and girls had been trapped in tiny, dark prison holes. The faces were dirty with filth and gaunt with hunger. Some of them were bloody or disfigured by wounds. Her stomach churned with tight, twisting confusion as she pushed herself on. She ran back up the tunnel in the direction she had come, desperate to get out of the prison and find her way up to the areas where she and the other members of the clan were allowed to be. She should have never entered the forbidden parts of the lair. When she finally reached an active tunnel, her heart filled with gratitude. Most of the tunnels of Dead Hollow were empty and abandoned, but some were still used frequently by those few Farron who still remained. She spotted two Farron adults walking ahead of her, both of them carrying bushels of leafy food gathered by the clan. She tried to look like a normal member of the clan going about her business, but it was difficult.
"Slow yourself down,"
one said to Willa as she hurried by with her head lowered. Her mind kept trying to make sense of what she'd seen in the prison behind her, but she knew she had to block it out. It didn't belong to her. It didn't involve her. They were prisoners of the clan. They were humans. They were the enemy. Whatever was happening down there must be something the Padawan wanted to be happening. She wasn't even supposed to be down there. And she vowed she'd never go into that horrible place again. As she hurried through the tunnels of the lair, with other Farron passing her this way and that, she kept to herself and she did not stop. She longed to get home to her den, to her mamma, just to see her, to fall into her gentle arms and her soothing words, to come back to the one person in the world who truly loved her. But she knew that wouldn't be the end of it. A heaviness loomed in her chest, a dark sense of foreboding like she'd never felt before. She'd done too much this time. She hadn't meant to, but she'd seen too much. She'd been so disobedient in so many ways against the laws of the clan and the will of the Padawan that she had no idea what was going to happen to her, except that it was going to be bad. Chapter 14. When Willa finally came to the tunnel that sloped down into the area of the lair she shared with her grandmother, a warm and gentle sense of relief poured through her body. What she'd seen in the prison still haunted her, but the immediacy of her fear and confusion began to fade as she followed the familiar path home. The walls on the way to her den weren't woven sticks like the rest of Dead Hollow, but a labyrinth of stone tunnels that had been bored and sculpted smooth by the flow of an ancient river. Some of the tunnels led to small caves, others to dead ends. One of the tunnels, which her mamma had warned her about many times, led to a drop-off into a black abyss. Some members of the clan believed that the dark hole of the abyss was the mouth of an ancient creature of the earth. Others believed that it was a bottomless pit that went on forever. She and her sister, Aliu, used to sneak away, crawl to the edge, and peer down into the hole. One time they dropped a rock into the darkness and waited. But they never heard it hit the bottom. The truth was, no one truly knew what was down there. There were many pits and dangers in the labyrinth, but Willa knew the maze of winding, interconnecting stone tunnels better than anyone, because it was the only way to her den. At long last, she came to the familiar tunnel close to home where the roof was permeated with smooth, round holes. River water had once poured through the holes, but now shafts of sunlight came filtering down instead, dappling the stone at her feet like rays of light shining through the leaves of great trees and touching the forest floor. This part of the labyrinth had once been inhabited by Farron of old, and of all the places in the lair, these were the tunnels where she felt most at home. The stone walls were covered with the charcoal drawings and colored paintings of the people who had lived here thousands of years before. On one wall were many stick-like figures with their arms and legs outstretched, swimming in rivers that were dry ravines now. Another wall showed crowds of people looking up in awe at a blazing sun blocked by a round shape, with stars and planets visible in the background. On a third wall, there were Farron men and women and children standing among tall trees as they gazed upon herds of large, horned animals that no longer existed in the world. But the most striking painting of all depicted what looked like a river that flowed along the length of one of the tunnel walls, but instead of curving lines of water, the river of souls consisted of thousands of handprints, some large, some small, some put there 1,000 years before, and others more recent.
"It's good to see you, sister,"
Willow whispered as she leaned down and pressed her open hands onto the 2 smallest and most recent pair of handprints on the wall. When she closed her eyes, she had a perfect memory of when she and Aliyu were just 5 years old, her mamma covering their hands with red paint, one sister's left hand and the other sister's right, and then, as if they had a single body, pressing their hands side by side into the ancient river of time.
"Never forget that you are forever among your people,"
her mamma had told the 2 of them.
"In the past, and in the present, and in the future to come."
The marks of her and Aliyu's hands still remained, so small now compared to Willa's living hands, like ghosts of who she and her sister had been. But Willa knew that she and Aliyu were still together in their souls, for among the Farron, who were always born in twins, the relationship between 2 twins was sacred. Twins always took care of each other, protected each other. There was no more noble deed than to support a twin, and no fouler crime than to forsake one. It was the bond that could not be broken. Whenever she came down this tunnel, it was like she was walking into a different time, a time long, long ago, when the Farron and the world were one, and true kinship held the clan together. Willa had lived here alone with her grandmother for as long as she could remember clearly in her mind. Everything else before was but a distant, clouded memory. Her mother's twin sister, who would have normally helped raise her with her parents, had died of oak wilt before Willa was born. Her father, Killian, and her mother, Nia, were slain by the Dayfolk when she was 6. And the humans murdered Aliyu that same night. She remembered her distraught, grief-stricken grandmother stumbling into their den, taking her up into her arms, and whispering in the old language,
"Your sister and your parents have passed away, my child,"
she had said.
"You and I are all that's left now, and we need to take care of each other. You'll be my twin, and I'll be yours."
Willa didn't know that night what those words meant, what it meant for someone to pass away, and she didn't understand how her life would change. But she learned in the shadowed days that followed. It felt like something had been torn away from her, bleeding and raw. She kept looking for a sister who wasn't there. She kept trying to speak with a mother and a father who could no longer hear her. The anguish and loneliness she felt was one of her oldest and most powerful memories. For the rest of her life, she had felt a dark hollowness in her soul, like something that should be there was missing. She couldn't remember her parents very well anymore, and she still didn't understand how or where they had been killed. But the fleeting fragments of her life with her twin sister before she died haunted her like the sounds of children playing in the distance. But her mamma, her mother's mother, had been with her all her life. Her mamma had been her teacher in the days before her parents and sister died, and her mamma had cared for her on her own every day since. She had taught her how to speak, how to blend, and how to find her way among the trees. As Willa walked through the doorway into the den, she knew that no matter what happened, no matter how she felt, no matter what she had done, she could count on one thing, that her mamma would be there waiting for her. Chapter 15.
Come here, child,
her grandmother whispered softly in the old language as Willa walked